From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, interesting, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake, our first guest, Mark Sunday, Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President for Oracle. Later this month, Larry Ellison and Team Oracle USA defend their 2013 America's Cup win in Bermuda. Mark Sunday, an America's Cup aficionado, really a super fan, will be with us in the studio to talk about this 166-year tradition, the technology introduced at the 2013 come-from-behind win, and America's upcoming defense for the Cup in Bermuda.
That's exciting stuff, especially for sailing fans. Good morning, John. Nice to have you back. Our second guest this morning is Dava Sobel, who has written a new book called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. It chronicles the relatively unknown and remarkable contributions to astronomy made by a group of women working in the Harvard College Observatory from the late 1800s through the mid-1900s. Enriched by excerpts from letters, diaries, and memoirs, The Glass Universe tells the riveting story of a group of remarkable women who expanded our knowledge of the universe and whose discoveries are still being used today.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Interestingly, for 166 years, America's Cup yacht racing speed has been, well, relatively flat. This all changed in 2013 when entry sported game-changing technologies, aerodynamics, and conditioning that drove speeds to 50 miles per hour. 2013 was also noteworthy as Oracle, down 8-1 in a best-of-17 defense, came back and won in what many say is the most exciting come-from-behind win in sports. Later this month, Team Oracle USA defends the Cup in Bermuda. Joining us now in the studio, Mark Sunday. He is a fan of this 166-year tradition. He will be stationed in Bermuda at the Team Oracle USA camp, and he joins us now in the studio. Mark Sunday, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. This is such a fascinating contest. Take us back to that first race in 1851. How did it come about? Who was in it? And maybe tell us who won.
Well, you know, being the CIO at Oracle, one of the things that I talk a lot about is disruptive technologies and how in innovation. And then also, since by coincidence, we also are associated with Larry, who's the owner of Oracle Team USA, I looked at tying the two together. And so it begins with this, the America's Cup goes back to 1851, but it really started with Queen Victoria and Prince Albert and the whole Great Exhibition. They built what was an innovation in and of itself, the Crystal Palace, which was the largest glass and iron building. And they had over 100,000 exhibits showing off the latest technologies and really, quite frankly, the prowess of Great Britain at the time. So it was really interesting things like the first printing press that could do 5,000 pages an hour or be able to fold envelopes at 2,700 envelopes an hour, all these technologies that were disruptive at the time, not only automation that improved, but then tremendously increased commerce. There are some other inventions that probably weren't so, let's just say they didn't last the test of time, like a leech-driven barometer or a locomotive that was powered by horses walking on a treadmill. But all these technologies, there's a lot of other things that were there. But one of the most important technologies of the time, if you think about it, is maritime. Whether it's for military or it's for how you get your raw materials. And it's certainly the most cost-effective way. And turns out it's still the most cost-effective way of moving goods, you know, around the world. And so as part of this, they wanted to exhibit just how powerful Great Britain was in the world of yachting and maritime. So they created this race around the Isle of Wight. And they offered it up to all nations to come and create a competitor. Well, it turns out this brand new yacht club, New York Yacht Club, a number of gentlemen got together, and based on the kind of the pilot boats of the time, they created this yacht, Yacht America, that was much, much different than any of the British yachts. This yacht was, instead of, you know, being wide in the front, narrow in the back, it tended to be wider, and all of the beam, in other words, the width, was towards the rear. Instead of these big, complex sail plans, they used something that was, you know, much more streamlined and aerodynamic. And they sailed this thing across to Europe, and quite frankly, blew away the British, and took home this, it was called the 100 Guinea Cup. That, you know, Queen Victoria handed to him.
Yeah. And was there anything to do with taxation in the British Empire that precluded them from putting maybe their best foot forward?
Well, you know, I heard that recently. I've yet to see that that's verified. I think really, when I look into it, is that, quite frankly, this was a disruptive innovation. And that's why I'm so fascinated about it, that these Americans had come up with a technology, a way of building boats that was dramatically different. In fact, it was on the front page of the paper, "If she's right, we must all be wrong." And in another thing, that with it was so disruptive that Queen Victoria asked, as Yacht America won the race, "Well, Your Majesty, who's in second?" was her query. And the response was, "Your Majesty, there is no second." It was such a disruptive technology in how the boat was built that it blew everything else away. And so, again, there's something relative to, you know, I'd heard that maybe the boats were narrower in British because they were taxed on their waterline. But I haven't seen that verified.
Yeah, interesting.
So interesting that Queen Victoria and all of Britain, it was their goal to show British maritime prowess, but it sort of backfired in a way because the America's yacht came along and sort of did them in. And has it, as we look historically in the 166 years or since that time, has it been called the America's Cup?
Yeah, so what happened was this original trophy, the 100 Guinea Cup, it's now the oldest trophy in international sports history, was deeded, was given over to the New York Yacht Club. And then a few years later, 1857, the folks that were remaining that were on the boat, they were thinking of melding it down and making medallions for each of the sailors. But they said, well, why don't we instead write a deed of gift that will make this trophy for international yacht racing amongst friendly nations? And so it was created based on this deed of gift, a trophy that would be then given out to the winner of these yacht races. And it was called the America's Cup to honor the very first yacht that won the race. And so that's why it's called America's Cup. So the trophy has been in competition since it was first the deed of gift, 1857. And it's been, now we're getting ready for the 35th edition.
And how many wins has our country taken home?
Okay, so this is another record for it. 132 year winning streak. The New York Yacht Club was able to hold on to it all the way to 1983. There were, really incredible challengers. Like, for example, Sir Lipton Sir Thomas Lipton from the Lipton Tea Company fame, tried 5 times to win this trophy. And he was an incredible gentleman, and each time would come with a new boat, a new version of Shamrock was the name of his boats. But the New York Yacht Club would then look at multiple defenders and have a competition to determine who they'd have defend it. It turns out that Sir Lipton was never able to win the trophy. It kept going on and on. There was always technology, always innovation involved with these boats. But it wasn't until 1983 that a new technology, a new innovation in yacht racing allowed the stronghold, the 132-year stronghold that the United States had on this trophy, to let it be released. And by the way, that's the time when I got really interested, captivated by the excitement around this trophy.
Talk about relative performance and speed from 1851 to 2013 and today.
Okay, so if you go back to 1851, the boats were probably doing 6-7 knots. And over time, you know, they got a bit faster, you know, 10, 12, 13 knots. You know, over a long period of time, the technology around the boats, the going from wood hulls to steel hulls, ultimately fiberglass hulls, you know, the advent of carbon fiber. So a number of things had changed around the materials, but the boat speed, you know, had marginally improved from 6 to 12, 15, 13, 14, 15 knots. But then, you know, everything changed, beginning really in 2010, when the race was done between a trimaran, which was the Oracle Team USA, and then against a Lingi, which was a catamaran. And these boats, you know, were considerably faster, but it was what was called a deed of gift challenge. So the boats weren't, you know, within a spec other than they couldn't be longer than 90 feet. But where it really changed was in 2013, where they design, the Defender and Challenger get together and come up with a rule. And they came up with this 72-foot catamaran design. And the thought was these boats would be faster, more exciting. But little did we know, did anyone know, when the rule was first put in place, that it would end up being a lot more exciting than they had anticipated. Turns out the Kiwis decided, well, we're going to lift the boat out of the water. We're going to take these dagger boards, which by the rule could be curved. Well, we're going to put enough of a curve in them that it's going to be a foil, and it's going to lift the boat entirely out of the water. And so we ended up with these 72-foot foiling boats that were approaching 40 knots. And could go 3 times the speed of the wind. And so that was 72-foot boats with 11-person crew. Now as we enter the 35th edition, they're 6-person boats. They're 50 feet long, but they're faster and much, much more maneuverable, designed from the beginning to be foiled. And we're going to see speeds in excess of 60 miles an hour.
So we have the hydrofoil, but we also have this fixed wing. This fixed sail, how big is that, and what does that do for the performance?
Okay, well, let's go back to 2010, when there was this challenge between where Switzerland, actually a landlocked country, had won the cup. And so Larry Ellison put together a team that built a trimaran. This trimaran was 15 feet long on the two outside hulls. The wing, a fixed wing, was the biggest wing that's ever been made, 224 feet tall. It would not fit underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. I mean, it's truly an amazing boat. And so what it is with a fixed wing, they're far, far more efficient than a soft sail. So the last America's Cup, the 2013 edition with the 72-foot sails were also fixed wings, and now we're looking for much better performance again, much more maneuverable fixed wing that are about I think they're roughly about 50 feet tall as well. No, actually 79 feet tall.
Wow. If you're just joining us, our guest is local resident and Chief Information Officer and Senior Vice President for Oracle. It's Mark Sunday. We're happy to have him in the studio to talk about the America's Cup. Practice races going on now in Bermuda for this edition of America's Cup beginning on May 26th. So, Mark, I'd like to talk to you. You know, if you read anything in the news about Larry Ellison, there's all of this commentary surrounding, you know, his nature, his competitive nature, the fact that he's this, sometimes called brash CEO of Oracle. What do you think it is? You know, you talked about disruptive technology and innovation, and if you could tie that into a bit of a conversation about the personality of Larry Ellison and even Oracle as a company, how it morphs into this winning combination for the boat that won the America's Cup in 2013.
You know, so Larry's always had a background of being competitive, you know, whether, you know, building a company starting with $1,200 a little over 35 years ago, or being a yacht racer. Throughout the 90s, Larry had won 5 consecutive Maxi World Championships. So he was a very, very accomplished sailor. And then around 2000, 2001, talking with some of his close crew and confidants, they decided, well, let's take on the ultimate challenge, the professional challenge, America's Cup. And so bought a boat and, you know, had a team that competed in 2003, 2007, but, was committed to win. And so ultimately did win in the big trimaran in 2010. But at that point in time, Larry committed to not just defend the title, but reinvent the whole event. His goal is to create something special, create Formula One racing-like excitement on the water. So in addition to defending, which he was very successful at doing in 2013, he invested in the entire event. From this one, you know, really important aspect is, while the speeds of the boat have changed dramatically, how spectators experience it changed perhaps even more so. Stan Honey, who originally invented putting the lines down for the NFL, you know, whether it be the line of scrimmage or first down marker, he's also a world-class sailor. And working with the America's Cup Foundation, you know, that Larry was putting together, wanted to make sailing an incredibly exciting spectator sport. And if you think about it, if you've got two boats on opposing tacks, if you were looking at it from a TV or from any perspective, it's hard to tell who's in charge. Well, using the technology that's won actually a few Emmys, you can actually see these grid lines on the water, projected on the water, as well as wind speed and so forth. And you can see how fast the boats are going and which boat's ahead and how fast they're coming towards each other. Other things that Larry insisted in doing was put cameras on each of the boat. So in 2013, we had 7 cameras and mics on all the sailors, so we could change the perspective and give you the feel for what it's actually being like on the boat. So creating not only a winning boat, but far more importantly, an incredible spectacle for how the race is done and create a lasting legacy for America's Cup. It's one of the reasons why it's in Bermuda. America's Cup racing is huge in Europe. So you put the race out in the middle of the Atlantic, it's prime viewing time for not only North America, but also for Europe as well. And so Larry's about building something huge, not just a winning boat, which we'd like to win again, but I think even more importantly is the lasting legacy, is reinventing sailing to really demonstrate how exciting it is. I believe that next Friday, May 26th, on NBC, will be the most exciting 25 minutes of live team sports in history. With watching these boats, with cameras on the boats, the water flying, the boats hitting 60 miles an hour, it's going to be exciting to see these boats. And by the way, you know, just like with NASCAR, you know, there's some crashes. Well, in practice, just over the last few weeks, our boats capsized a couple of times. And, you know, there's quite a bit of excitement. So it's going to be interesting next Friday to see when these boats are, when it starts counting or racing against each other.
So America's Cup, been around since 1851. Sailing in itself, a sport steeped in tradition. Has Larry Ellison had, you know, challenged roadblocks along the way saying, no, that's not how we do it, and he's a guy who's all about innovation. You know, talk about that, some of the challenges to revolutionizing, not only from a standpoint of the boat itself, but as you say, the spectator event.
Well, I think what he wanted to do is create an event that will not only engage sailors, but engage others as well. You know, for Race 19 in San Francisco, there were millions, literally millions of people around San Francisco Bay watching the race. And the goal is with this upcoming America's Cup that we captivate non-sailing audience as well, is introduce folks to just how exciting competitive sailing can be. But along the way, you know, if you just look back to what should have been the boats for 2013, it was kind of interesting what they did. They actually created races with both, you know, the traditional monohull, a single hull, as well as what we ended up choosing was catamarans, to just see what could you make the most exciting racing with. So I think the whole idea of experimentation, making investments, looking at what will provide the ultimate, not only sailing competition, but the ultimate spectator experience. So, you know, I think there's just been this commitment to excellence, and how do we make this, you know, it's exciting, lasting, and really build a legacy around it as we can.
Mark, talk about the technologies that are used to monitor the real-time performance of not only the boat, but the sailors on the boat.
So the if you think about sailing yachts, from 1851 all the way up to 2007, you know, the technology didn't change a lot about how you're sailing the boat. But in 2010, we, you know, a fixed wing, we started putting a lot of sensors on the boat so we can measure, you know, what the pressures were and so forth. A conventional soft sail, that when people think of sailboats, they think of a, you know, a cloth or, you know, a flexible material sail, you can actually see it deflect. Well, a wing, you can't see anything at all. So the only way you can tell this, the what the pressure is and the loads, is actually using sensors. So using Internet of Things technology, we put a number of sensors and we're getting thousands of data points a second. But if you fast forward just literally a few years to where we're at in 2017, we're doing 40,000 data points a second. We have 300 sensors scattered across the wing as well as other parts, so we can measure all the loads and determine what are the optimal settings for all the aspects of the wing, as well as what are the appropriate levels in which, in order to, you know, sail the boat to optimize its boat speed. But these athletes, there, it takes an incredible amount of power to sailor power to make these boats move. In addition to, you know, being able to move this giant wing, but also up and down the foils and raise them and change the angle of them, we have humans that are needing to put out hundreds of watts of power continuously for 25 minutes. Basically, what they're doing is the Kiwis are using pedal power. Most of the other boats are using conventional winches, but they're putting hydraulic pressure in. And then this pressure then it can be called upon instantaneously. So we have a 50-foot boat that's balancing basically on a foil the size of a surfboard. So real time, we're having to keep that boat balanced. Jimmy Spittle, the helmsman of our boat, needs to be able to react. He's got push buttons on the helm that he can change the pitch in order to keep it level. If you can think just slightly, if just the bow of the boat hits the water, it's going to immediately flip at going at that kind of speed. So within 100 milliseconds, he's got to adjust the angle. All that's done real-time monitoring. So the athletes themselves, they have to put out an incredible amount of power, perhaps more power than we've ever seen any other athletes. And by the same time, their heart rate's 170 beats per minute. They have to solve complex problems as they're trying to sail this unbelievable machine. So the athletes are as much about the technology as the boats themselves.
Let's talk about sailing strategies. I understand from a talk that I attended that you gave that you can't steal a competitor's air or block air, but the start is still very strategic and very important. Can you talk about starting strategies and how important that is to winning a race?
Well, in match racing, America's Cup is a match race, and there's two kinds of sailing. It's fleet racing, where you have a whole fleet of boats, but America's Cup is match racing. It's where one boat against another. The boats enter the starting area 10 minutes prior to the race from opposing tacks, and the goal is to maneuver so you have the best position when the gun actually goes off and you cross the starting line. You want to be at your maximum speed, but you also want to be in a position that you can take advantage of sailing rules. In sailing rules, like driving, there's right of way. And so if you're on starboard tack, you have right of way over the other boat. And so you want to be on the optimal tack with the optimal position and optimal speed, so as you head towards the first mark, you're better positioned. So the start is absolutely critical to the race. But, you know, our thought is, as we're moving into the 35th America's Cup, that these boats are going to be so fast, so competitive, that there's going to be a number of lead changes. And so winning the start's critical, but staying ahead throughout the entire race is also going to be something that's going to require a lot of salesmanship.
We just have a minute left, and we're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately. But if you could just take maybe 30 seconds and talk about what you're going to be doing. You're going to be at Camp Oracle at the Fairmont. How long are you going to be there, and what races are you going to attend?
So where we're at right now is there are five challengers, five different countries that are going to compete to be the challenger for the America's Cup. So those races start next Friday, May 26th, and will run into mid-June. And so by that time, we'll be down to one challenger that's going to take on Oracle Team USA for the Cup. And so there's a series of races. My wife and I are going to make it there for the last weekend, which it will be down to the final four or five races. So we'll be there for the winning races and hopefully see Oracle Team USA win this for the third time.
And last weekend, the final weekend of races is when?
June 24th, 25th, 26th, 27th.
I have to have you back to do a little recap.
So great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Mark Sunday, Chief Information Officer, Senior Vice President for Oracle, also a big fan of the America's Cup. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, when we return, we're going to have a conversation with Dava Sobel, who has written The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. The Epic School Kids program gives all children across the state of Utah from kindergarten through fifth grade 5 days of skiing plus 1 day rental and lesson. More information at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and companies support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Mark Sunday of Oracle about the upcoming Defense of America's Cup. It's starting on May 26th. It's in Bermuda. You can tune in. Sounds really exciting. Our next guest is Deva Sobel, who has written a new book, fascinating book, called The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. In the mid-19th century, the Harvard College Observatory began employing women as calculators or human computers to interpret the observations that their male counterparts made via telescope each night. At the outset, this group included the wives, the sisters, and daughters of the resident astronomers. But soon, the female corps included the graduates of the new women's colleges like Vassar, Wellesley, and Smith. As photography transformed the practice of astronomy, the ladies turned from computation to studying the stars captured nightly on glass photographic plates. Deva Sobel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
Oh, we're so glad that you could be here. I mean, and I have to start with, of course, the book by Margot Lee Shetterly, The Hidden Figures. And I start with that because so many people in this country and around the world saw the movie Hidden Figures. And I think what we say collectively is, why did we never hear this story before? And you say something kind of interesting, something like, you know, women have always been in history, but have never, quote unquote, made history, or history has never been told about women before.
Yes, they've been in the past, but they haven't been part of history.
There we go. Yeah, and so you obviously have been studying this for quite some time. Talk about your orientation and your fascination for the story, or how you found the story.
I'm interested in astronomy. I've been writing about it for a long time. And a little over 20 years ago, I was interviewing astronomer Wendy Friedman. At the time, she was head of a Hubble telescope key project about the expansion rate of the universe. And she mentioned the name Henrietta Swan Leavitt as someone who had lived 100 years earlier, but whose work was pivotal to the Hubble project. And I had never heard of her. And then when I went to learn more about Miss Leavitt, I discovered she had been working in a room full of women at the Harvard Observatory. And a room full of women is nothing I ever associated with Harvard at that time in history. So I was interested right away. And the story just got better as I learned how many women were involved and the importance of the work they did.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about Harvard College at that time and the observatory being so male-dominated. I didn't realize the extent to which it was.
Well, astronomy was male. The university was extremely so. But the observatory was something like a wholly disowned subsidiary. It belonged to the university, but it was under its own management. And the director, Edward Pickering, had a very open-minded attitude towards women. He believed they could do the work and that they should be given the chance. And he provided an extraordinary opportunity and gave the women full credit for the discoveries they made. The only negative thing I can say about him is that he paid them a little less than he paid the men. So it was an economically sound move on his part to hire women because he could have more employees.
Yeah, and Harvard Astrophysics on Garden Street in Harvard Square was just an extraordinary place. I mean today there are 200.
It still is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, today there are 250 astrophysicists that are there that have nothing to do with teaching. Have nothing to do. I mean, they're doing research. They're running projects. They originally ran the Hubble Space Telescope out of Garden Street, and I could never get into Harvard University as an undergraduate. But you can go to night courses. Anybody can go. And I took some courses there. And one night we're working on a project late at night with our professor Eric Chazon, and he brought out some plates, some glass plates, and told us the story. Very abbreviated story. Your book really filled in everything, but it was just fascinating. And we looked at these plates and also talked about the technology of the plates, where early plates might show five or six stars, and as the plates became more sensitive, they could show 500 or 600 stars in that same sector of the universe that the telescope was pointing to. And it's just very exciting. How many plates were developed?
There are still 500,000 of these glass plates on Garden Street in the brick building that was originally constructed to hold them. Because the old observatory was a beautiful wooden building. And as soon as these photographs began to be collected, the director developed a terror of fire because he recognized right away how important they would be as a permanent record of the night sky and a way to show changes in the stars over time. So he put up a brick building. It had to be expanded twice over a century, and it's still there. And people who are interested can go, and the curator will be happy to show you a plate and give you a magnifying glass and see how much you can see in there.
And these plates are extraordinarily important today because, as you tell the story in the book, they are now being digitized so that permanent records, you don't have to worry about the glass breaking or fires breaking out or anything like that. Digitizing these, this will be a database of our universe that any astronomer can interrogate and look at and study.
Exactly, and do it from a home office, a laptop, anywhere, without having to travel to Harvard to look at the plates. Years ago, Director Pickering would send the glass plates to people whose work required them. He was very trusting, but that really can't be done anymore.
Let's talk a little bit about Dr. Henry Draper, because this is one of the ways in which women become involved as well at the observatory at Harvard. His wife, for example, and a niece, I believe, of his, became involved. And this is one of the ways wives, sisters, nieces, daughters got involved as helpers. So talk a little bit about him to begin with.
Henry Draper was a medical doctor, but a very serious and passionate amateur astronomer. And at that time, the amateurs really did all the interesting work. The professional astronomers were pretty much stuck mapping the stars for the purpose of navigation. But he had complete freedom, and he had his wife's money, and he became an expert on looking at the spectra of the stars, so passing the starlight through a prism, so that the light was spread out into a long strip with a pattern of dark and light lines. Mm. And from those patterns, people could read the chemical composition of the stars. And Draper was thrilled about this because people never thought it would be possible to analyze the chemistry of the stars. And he had a wonderful way of being excited about it. He said that spectroscopy had made the chemist's arms millions of miles long. And he was the first person who succeeded in photographing the spectrum of a star. This was extremely difficult to do, but it was such an important achievement. He decided to completely change his life, give up everything else he was doing, and photograph the spectra so as to create a classification system to be able to figure out the various types of stars and what made them different from one another. And just when he had his life set up to do this, he developed pneumonia and died at age 45.
And
so
Oh, I was going to say, so his wife, Anna Palmer Draper,
Anna Palmer Draper, who had been his helper, his assistant through the 15 years of their marriage, she appealed to Pickering to do the work in her husband's name and promised to give Harvard her personal fortune if they would do that. And Pickering was fascinated by the work and delighted at the prospect of tripling his budget, and he accepted. And she continued to support that work for the rest of her life, so another 30 years, and even had the foresight to leave money to care for it long after her death, which is why it's still intact today, the collection of plates.
And Henrietta Swan Leavitt, I mean, you know, you're talking about the spectral range of the stars and being able to understand chemical composition, but Henrietta Swan Leavitt really found a lot of variable stars that pulsate from lighter to brighter over their period, over their frequency of time, and that has had a tremendous amount to do. I mean, she put this together, a tremendous amount to do with really understanding distances of these star systems.
Her observations led to a means for determining distances over vast reaches of space, much farther than had been possible before. And that was why Wendy Friedman was so beholden to her. And her discovery for years had been called the period-luminosity relation, just as you said, relating the time it takes a variable star to cycle through its changes to its true brightness. But now people are starting to call it the Leavitt Law.
Yeah. And so the longer the period, the longer the frequency between dimmer and brighter, the further the star would be away. Is that correct?
The brighter the star.
The brighter the star.
So then if you observe a star with that period and it looks much dimmer than it should, you know it's very much farther away, and you can calculate the distance.
As you did all this research, what surprised you most about this story?
I love the lives of the women. Miss Cannon, Annie Jump Cannon, who created the stellar classification system that's still used today, she was a lifelong diarist, and I had boxes of her diaries. And I had been told she was a suffragette. So I immediately looked up her diary for the first moment when she would have been allowed to vote. And sure enough, she shot right to the poll to vote in the primary election and then the presidential election. And I think the most surprising thing of all was the effect that the presence of the women, both the women who worked there and the women who funded the research, because there were several heiresses who got interested in this work and supported it generously. They made it possible for many young women to come in from various college programs and work at Harvard for a year and then go on to a job in another observatory. So these women infiltrated the field, and some of them are really the grandmothers of the hidden figures. They made it normal for observatories to have women employees.
Mm.
And so when the first graduate-level education program in astronomy was instituted at Harvard, the only money available for graduate student fellowships were these special scholarships that had been set up expressly for women. So all the first graduate students in astronomy at Harvard came from the women's colleges, and the first Harvard PhD in astronomy went to one of them, to Cecilia Payne.
That's such a great story. And so talk about some of the funding now for graduate students or even undergraduate students. Are there still those kinds of grants and scholarships set up for women?
Well, there still is the Annie Jump Cannon Prize, which Ms. Cannon established herself to encourage a young astronomer, a young woman astronomer in her career. And today, as all fields of science try to be more inclusive, some people feel that award should change and should really be for a young astronomer, not necessarily a young woman. But at the moment, it still is awarded annually to a woman.
I can't help but keeping my thoughts focused on the fact that a lot of these young women didn't even have the right to vote, yet they were winning honorary degrees and making great contributions to science, making, you know, putting their name in the history books without even being able to vote.
They were happy to have that opportunity.
You tell this remarkable story about these women and their accomplishments and what they did, but you also talk about their personalities and about who they were in their regular life. And what strikes me is, in reading your book, these women are now gone. I would love to sit down with a few of them, just have a cup of coffee. I mean, they just sound fascinating. And I mean,
They would have enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, my goodness. Catherine Wolfe Bruce, New York Harris, she didn't develop an interest in astronomy until she was in her 70s. And she made great contributions after that.
Yes, and not only to Harvard. She helped Harvard build a giant telescope in the Southern Hemisphere so they could continue the work they were doing to encompass the entire sky, because you can't see the whole sky from the Northern Hemisphere. And then she was so excited she wanted to make gifts to other astronomers. And Pickering, the director at Harvard, in his generous way, helped her find people all over the world who needed some money either for an instrument or to hire some extra help to do the calculations. Whatever it was, people could apply, and then Pickering would help pick out the most worthy applications, and she would write checks.
Yeah. You must love walking around Garden Street, 60 Garden Street, and just seeing everything there. Did you spend much time there?
I did spend a lot of time there. Also, in the plate stacks, everything that's part of the Center for Astrophysics has that same 60 Garden Street address, even though there are quite a few buildings that answer to it. And there's a wonderful library there, an astronomy library. And most of the observatory's historical holdings are down in Harvard Yard at the university archives. But the whole area is shining with history. Just this week on Monday, a group of us went to the Mount Auburn Cemetery, where many of the people who worked at the observatory are now buried. And on May 15th, which was the birthday of Wilhelmina Fleming, one of the more interesting characters in the story, we had a little service for her and a visit to her grave and Mr. and Mrs. Pickering. And I think people feel a real connection with these characters.
Yeah. And Albert Einstein, of course, was at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. But he kept an office on Garden Street, and he would visit it somewhat regularly. And also, I would just mention one other thing. I think it's on Tuesdays at lunchtime. Any astrophysicist there in the facility, anybody outside of the facility, including, you know, the people that were going to the classes, could sit down, and they would have these open debates, and they would bring lunch in. I went a couple of times. I didn't say anything. I just sat back and watched. But I think there were always more women there than there were men.
Well, there really are quite a large number of women now. The graduate students, probably 45% are women now in astronomy at Harvard.
That's incredible. Our guest is Dava Sobel. She's the author of many books, but including her latest, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And I just have to ask you, I mean, you've been around writing about science for a long time, a former New York Times science reporter. You've contributed to Audubon, Discover, The New Yorker, and you've written a handful of books, bestsellers, I might add. And I'm just wondering how you see the evolution of women in science and how particularly you see young girls getting turned on to science now and how that has changed over the years you've been working in the field.
Oh, it's changed a great deal. As a teenager, I went to the Bronx High School of Science in New York, and it was a public school. It was free, but you had to pass an entrance exam. And on the day of the exam, we were told that boys would be accepted preferentially over girls in a ratio of about 4 to 1. And nobody thought that was odd or unusual. It was just the way things were. I'm 70 now, so this was a long time ago. But I've seen a great deal of change. Just today, I learned the news that the 2017 Gruber Foundation Prize in Cosmology, which is a huge honor, has been given to Sandra Faber, the University of California Observatories. So women are really up there in astronomy. It's a great thing to see.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for writing this book. It's fascinating. Again, Dava Sobel, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.
And it's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
This is Beth, owner of Peak Art and Frame, local sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame offers local artwork as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Now, welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Well, Elon Musk, he started SolarCity, SpaceX, Tesla, had this Hyperloop thing going. Well, he started another company. It's called The Boring Company. It started with a tweet. Elon Musk proclaimed that he has a new venture. It's a tunnel boring machine that'll start digging in a month or so. It's already started digging. And he's already made good on his word. It is a tunnel boring machine that's going to go way, way down, and it's going to... he's going to put cars on high-speed platforms, and it's going to be for Hyperloop. I mean, the guy just keeps going.
He just cannot stop. And he succeeds at what he starts. That's the wild thing about it.
Yeah. It's
tunnel boring.
Yeah.
Many tunnels passing through the mountains. Like in Europe, for example, in Switzerland, they already have the technology where they load your car on a train platform,
right,
and you go through the tunnel. But imagine doing it at Hyperloop speed.
Yes.
It's crazy.
And these tunnels are going to go deep.
Yeah. Well, it's Cool Science Radio. Thanks to our guest today, Mark Sunday from Oracle and Dava Sobel with The Glass Universe. You've been listening to KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
We'd like to thank our underwriters today, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. It's KPCW Park City. Time now for